Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Less than 24 hours after the Oklahoma tornadoes, the NBA's Thunder answered in resounding fashion, as did their superstar, Kevin Durant. Ahead on Only a Game, a conversation with Oklahoma City Thunder general manager Sam Presti. Also, the surprising Cleveland Indians stay hot, and a marathoner takes on the hills and the wild boars of the 2013 Tour de France course. Also ahead, spring kayakers in northeast Minnesota remember a kayaking legend.
Sort of looked like the friendly Norwegian troll. Sort of had long, kind of dreadlocky hair and a big, long, unkempt beard. Had little eyes that twinkled like an elf.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game is provided by Oliver Wyman. Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals serving global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The Oklahoma City Thunder was knocked out of the NBA playoffs on May 15th, and yet they have remained very active in the postseason. On Tuesday, the team announced a $1 million donation to the American Red Cross and the Salvation Army to bolster relief efforts in the wake of Monday's tornadoes in central Oklahoma. Also on Tuesday, the Red Cross announced that Thunder All-Star forward Kevin Durant had himself pledged $1 million to the cause. Joining me now is Thunder General Manager Sam Presti. Mr. Presti, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you for having me.
The team's decision to pledge $1 million came very quickly after the disaster. Whose decision was it?
Well, obviously, everything starts at the top with our ownership group led by Clayton Bennett. But I can tell you just from the mission of the organization and the values that run so deeply through the community in Oklahoma City that it wasn't a decision that had to be mulled over very long.
Kevin Durant has declined to talk about his personal donation, saying he'd prefer to have it speak for itself. Were you surprised by the amount of that donation and by his humility?
We're incredibly fortunate not only to have Kevin Durant represent us on the basketball floor, but he represents Oklahoma City and this state and this community in an exemplary fashion. I wish I could tell you that I was surprised, but having been around this young person for 6 years now, this is who he is. It's authentic, it's real, and I think it's one of the reasons why he's so beloved in this community.
Have his teammates followed suit?
Yeah, everybody within the team on the roster has inquired to our organization as to ways they can contribute, whether it's visits to children's hospitals, touring the scene, and speaking with people who are going through the remains of their homes and spending some time to support them or going to shelters in the area. These are the things that are much more lasting than wins and losses in Oklahoma City. And I'm very proud of our players. I'm proud of our organization because this community has supported us so much over the last 5 years. And this is an opportunity for us to stand by them and support them in a time of need.
Does the Thunder place more emphasis on community relations than is the case with other NBA teams?
You know, it's hard for me to comment on other teams and how they organize their efforts in the community. But I can tell you that, in Oklahoma City, it's front and center in all that we do. We embrace our part in the community as a leader when called upon. We understand that, the Oklahoma standard is something you adopt when you live here, when you work here. And we take that very seriously. And I feel strongly that when our players run out of the tunnel and take the floor and they have Oklahoma City across their chest, that with each year that we're here and more people that we meet, it means that much more to them.
Does the team have an ongoing plan to help out with the reconstruction of this area? Because obviously this isn't something that's going to go away just when it's out of the headlines.
That's something that we've made a very strong indication to everyone that we speak with, whether it's Salvation Army, Red Cross, or the individuals directly is that this is a long process. This is the beginning stages of that process. And organizationally, we're prepared to continually invest our time and our resources. It's going to take all of us to help the people of Moore and the surrounding areas recover, and we stand ready to do that.
I understand that you were born in Massachusetts and that you played your college basketball right down the road from us at Emerson College. What does it feel like to be an Oklahoma resident now?
Well, you know, I call this my home. The people here have adopted me as one of theirs, even though I'm from the Northeast. I try to get back to the Northeast when I can. I love it. But I also understand that, to be involved on a ground level, with this being only our fifth season of existence in Oklahoma City, is a tremendous opportunity and not one that I take for granted.
Sam Presti is general manager of the Oklahoma City Thunder. Sam, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
To donate to the Oklahoma relief effort, please visit redcross.org/OKC. Four times in the last 6 years, the San Jose Sharks entered the postseason as a favorite to hoist the Stanley Cup, and so far, they have never done that. Joining me now to discuss whether the tantalizingly good Sharks will finally clasp the coveted goblet in their toothy jaws is David Pollack of the San Jose Mercury News. David, the Sharks are going into Sunday's game behind 2-3 against the L.A. Kings in the second round of this postseason. Are San Jose fans thinking, no, not again?
I'm pretty sure there is some of that going on. There's actually probably a lot of that going on because fans are kind of conditioned that that's the way these things end up every spring.
Shark center Joe Thornton was dominant in Game 4, not so much in Game 5. Is it fair to say that the Sharks will need two epic games from him if they're going to advance to the Western Conference Finals?
I think it's not just him. After the loss in Game 5, Logan Couture talked about the best players were far from the best players, and he was including himself in that group. But Joe certainly took control of things in that win, and they're going to need a much better game out of him than they got this time around.
Let's try and stay positive. Who else has been contributing when the Sharks have gone well?
It's actually like Logan was saying, their best players have been their best players, and it would be different guys on different nights, but they were the familiar cast of characters, Patrick Marleau, Joe Thornton, Dan Boyle. You have to include Logan Couture in that group now. He's actually probably taken a bigger share of the national spotlight away from those other guys than he has in the past, although the coaches here and the fans here know that Logan's been doing a lot of the heavy lifting for a while now.
The NHL suspended San Jose forward Rafi Torres through this entire series after his illegal hit to the head of Jarrett Stoll in Game 1, and San Jose was fined $100,000 after general manager Doug Wilson's criticism of that discipline. How have the fine and the suspension gone over in San Jose?
Hockey is such a strange sport because you've got a guy that you've watched for years and you think, what a nasty guy that is, and he's the worst kind of villain, and then he wears your jersey and suddenly you come to his defense. I've seen it happen elsewhere. I think that happened a lot here with Rafi Torres. He has tried to clean up his act this year. He has been very successful at that until this one hit. Fans liked the energy he brought to the team. He had goal-scoring skills they didn't expect. There was actually kind of a very pro-Rafi Torres movement underway, and I don't think this hit necessarily deters that. And I think that, if anything, the general manager, Doug Wilson, curried favor with the fans by coming strongly to defense of his player.
If San Jose was able to win the Stanley Cup, how would their fans respond?
The same as any place, except maybe more so than some. it always bothered me that Colorado won a Stanley Cup the very first year the franchise moved there from Quebec. I always thought fans are supposed to suffer for a while before they get the joy of winning a Stanley Cup. The Sharks have suffered for a while, and again, it's because they have high expectations every year. I think the fan base, and I think it would be kind of nuts there.
David Pollack covers the Sharks for the San Jose Mercury News. You can find a link to his Working the Corners blog by visiting our website, onlyagame.org. David, thank you very much for speaking with me.
My pleasure, Bill.
Late Thursday afternoon, as the Cleveland Indians prepared for a game against the Boston Red Sox at Fenway Park, several members of the team were watching a couple of ESPN analysts discuss whether the Indians could sustain the streak that had landed them atop the American League's Central Division. I asked pitcher Scott Kazmir, who is trying to revive his career after spending last season in the minors, whether he or any of the rest of the Indians took any of that analysis seriously.
Something for them to talk about, that's all it is. It's just entertainment right now, that's all it is. It's just one guy's going to take one side and they're in debate, that's all it is. It's just entertainment.
As a pitcher, Kazmir explains the early success of the Indians in simple terms.
You get a lot more confidence when you're after the first or second inning and you're up by three or four runs. That's for sure. It sets the tone. You go out there and attack the hitters a little bit more just to be able to get them off balance.
First baseman Mark Reynolds has been among those responsible for lots of the support Cleveland pitchers have enjoyed. He leads the team in home runs and runs batted in. Meanwhile, outfielder Michael Brantley, around 300 this spring, has been hitting about 30 points above his career average. Three Indians pitchers had the opportunity to work comfortably on Thursday when the Indians clobbered the Red Sox 12-3. After that game, the Indians stood second in the American League in runs scored, but that heady statistic notwithstanding, Cleveland bench coach Sandy Alomar, who spent 11 of his 20 seasons as a major league player with the Indians, says anybody looking to explain the team's success must consider the pitching.
I think our starting rotation has done a much better job than anticipated. Everybody thought that at this point we were going to have a deep rotation. I mean, by numbers and a track record number don't dictate that, but so far they have given us the opportunity to stay in games. And I think that's been the biggest surprise, our pitch is keeping us in the game.
Given that Cleveland finished 68-94 last season, the success they've enjoyed this spring also has to be considered at least a little surprising. Slugger Jason Giambi, who recently joined the Indians after he'd hit 429 home runs for various other teams during 18 years in the big leagues, feels a lot of the credit should go to manager Terry Tito Francona.
Everybody knows who Tito is. I mean, he's one of the few guys on this planet that can manage and be friends with his players. He lets you know exactly where you stand. He's fair, and I think you can't ask for anything more from a manager.
Francona, who was managing the Red Sox when they won the World Series in 2004 and 2007, found a warm welcome when he returned to Fenway Park on Thursday evening as the opposing manager. Before the game, he acknowledged that taking a seat in the visitors' dugout was a little disorienting.
I mean, every game I've ever been here, I've never rooted against the Red Sox. Now I will be like crazy.
Francona, who spent a year as a TV analyst after the Red Sox fired him in 2011, acknowledged that managing in Boston had sometimes been extremely stressful. But when one of the Boston writers observed that he seemed to be pretty relaxed, the Cleveland manager made it clear that his goals hadn't changed.
If I am relaxed, I kept reminding people I wasn't going to Cleveland to go to pasture. I mean, every game means the same to me here in Cleveland as it ever did here. Our goals are exactly the same as to win the game we're playing. But I like where I'm at. I'm really comfortable with where I'm working and who I'm working with. And it doesn't mean we're not going to have challenges, because we are. But I am enjoying the idea of tackling them with the people I'm with.
So a new, albeit experienced, manager who's happy with his job, a sprinkling of veterans to remind the younger players that staying at the top of the division won't be easy, better pitching than most people expected, and lots of offense. Maybe Cleveland fans, who are accustomed to being tantalized by teams that fade as spring gives way to summer, can begin anticipating a better run. I thought Chicago should have the title, said Clinton Shepard, and he wasn't talking about the Cubs. He had in mind the Guinness World Record for Ferris wheel riding, and he spent 48 hours, 8 minutes, and 25 seconds last weekend on the Ferris wheel at Chicago's Navy Pier to back up his words. For comfort, Shepard equipped his Ferris wheel gondola with cushions, curtains, and a big screen TV. He watched James Bond and Batman movies. As he was allowed a 5-minute break each hour, he welcomed fellow riders willing to make a donation to the USO. On one series of spins, he was joined by his girlfriend for a candlelight dinner. That's how he rides. If you catch your hair in the Ferris wheel unturned, in the Ferris wheel unturned. I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, Willie and Mickey with no mention of the Duke. But first, this week's Senior PGA Championship in St. Louis is the year's first major for golfers 50 and over. All healthy and eligible former PGA champions were present at the outset, except for Vijay Singh. This year, Singh was briefly suspended from the PGA Tour over the use of deer antler spray, which was once on the World Anti-Doping Agency's list of banned substances. Singh filed a lawsuit earlier this month against the PGA Tour over allegations of public humiliation and ridicule. As Only a Game's Greg Eklund reports, some wonder whether that was a good move for Singh.
Vijay Singh won his last major at the 2004 PGA Championship. After that win, he declared,
"This is a living for me, you know. This is my livelihood. I go out there. When I first came out here, I just wanted to make a good living. And then I started playing really well, and my motivation, you know, got stronger and stronger. I wanted to win golf tournaments, and then I wanted to win majors. And, you know, now I just want to go out there and win."
Since his Rookie of the Year season on the PGA Tour in 1993, Singh has accumulated more than $67 million, the third best of all time on the tour's career earnings list. But lately, Singh has commanded more attention for his decisions off the course than for his birdies and bogeys. Rather than join his 50 and over peers at this week's Senior PGA Championship in St. Louis, Singh chose to play the Invitational at the Colonial Country Club in Fort Worth, Texas, an unusual move for a former PGA Championship winner. Bob Tway, who won the PGA Championship in 1986, says Singh has earned the right to remain on the regular tour.
"There's no reason to even set foot out here, no matter what the tournament is."
But on the subject of Singh suing the PGA Tour, Tway questions the move.
"My feeling on was it that, you know, he kind of, you know, maybe did something that was kind of maybe wasn't supposed to do, and they got him out of it or whatever. I think I just leave well enough alone."
John Garrity, a golf writer who profiled Vijay Singh for Sports Illustrated in 1996, was reporting from the Colonial this week. He says Singh's choice of playing at the Colonial instead of the Senior PGA Championship stirs up memories of 10 years ago when Annika Sorenstam came off the LPGA Tour to play with the men.
"Vijay ties into that because he made some ungallant comments that week to the effect that he didn't think that women should be playing in men's tournaments, and he got a lot of heat and publicity because of that."
PR isn't one of Singh's strengths. He could have made a big splash in his first senior event by playing at the Belrive Country Club, the same course where he played his first U.S. major in 1992. But he doesn't lack supporters. Brad Faxon favors Singh's decision to bypass the year's first senior major.
"I totally respect these guys that, like Vijay, that can compete on a daily basis on the PGA Tour. I don't think he has an obligation to come out here. But at the same time, this is one of our big tournaments, so, you know, I'm not looking at Vijay thinking he's doing the wrong thing. I think it's cool."
All the details of Singh's lawsuit haven't yet been made public. In the meantime, Garrity says he wonders if Singh's claims that the PGA Tour sullied his reputation might backfire on him.
"The biggest problem with that argument is the fact that there were some blots on Vijay's reputation long before this deer antler spray controversy ever came up. And it's a puzzle to most of us in the golf business that Vijay would make a case out of this because it just draws attention to his earlier problems."
Victories for Singh are scarce now. He hasn't finished any better than 20th this season, perhaps competing against his peers in the 50 and over set. Sooner rather than later will give him, to use a golf term, a mulligan, a chance for a fresh start. For Only a Game, I'm Greg Eklund.
The start of the Tour de France is still 5 weeks away, which means it's not quite time to start hearing about how difficult it is to ride a bicycle more than 2,000 miles. If all goes according to plan, one day before the winner takes his victory lap down the Champs-Élysées, Zoe Romano will finish running the Tour de France course without the assistance of gears or wheels. 2 years ago, Ms. Romano ran 2,800 miles across the United States to raise money for the Boys and Girls Club. I spoke with her earlier this week, 6 days into her latest journey, and I started by asking how far she had gone.
"I am right now in Aix-en-Provence, and I've gone about 150, 160 miles. So I'm in the middle of the second stage of the tour.
I understand that your journey has not been entirely without incident. Please tell us a little about wild boars, firemen, and non-functional cell phones.
Yes. So yesterday I was on a mountain trail. Alex, who was with me driving for support, left, and I was on my own. And I'm coming down this trail, and it's a beautiful view of Marseille far in the distance. And I look ahead, and I see a wild boar. And I saw them on my U.S. run, but this was twice as big, just one of the scariest moments of my life, and kind of grunted at me and made that move like it was going to charge. And I just turned around and booked it back up the mountain and back to what I thought was safety. I don't really know, but it was pretty frightening.
And where did the firemen come into this?
Well, we got back on the road, and we came down to this sort of impasse, and we couldn't drive over it. And I think it was a coincidence. There were firemen there trying to help a communications employee work on the cell phone towers. And we said, you know, parlez-vous anglais, and told them what we were doing. And I guess we weren't allowed to be on those roads. So they sort of escorted us back. They were really nice. One of the firemen's girlfriends is from America. And I guess she's also a very active individual. You know, I'm sure they thought we were a little crazy, but it's normal. Comes with the territory.
Yeah, active is active, but running 2,000 miles over the Tour de France course is something else altogether. Tell me how you came up with the idea of running the course.
Well, after I ran across the U.S. 2 years ago, this past year I knew I wanted to do another adventure, and I wanted to make it, you know, a worthy follow-up to a run across the U.S. because you can't just follow that up with anything. The idea to do the Tour de France came to mind just because it's known as one of the world's most grueling endurance events. It's sort of a way for me to, you know, pay respect to cycling, but also sort of be, you know, kind of like a rascal, like I'm going to run your sport's toughest race on foot and see if I can do it.
What do you have in terms of a support crew?
I have Alex, my boyfriend, and that's it. He's making a film about the run. So he's also filming, sort of going into the towns and the communities and the hosts we're staying with. Some roads are not always accessible by car, but he's there when I need him.
Now, I understand that you're trying to raise money for the World Pediatric Project. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, World Pediatric Project, they're an international nonprofit. They're based in Richmond, Virginia, where I live, and they provide life-changing, life-saving medical care to children in the Eastern Caribbean and Central America. We got to meet their patients, and we got to see what they do in the field, and we're just really impressed by the quality of care that they provide, and they're thinking for the long term. So it's not just that they go down and provide surgeries and then leave. It's really a long-term medical care.
Zoe, I really appreciate your taking the time to speak with me, and I imagine you must be devoting most of your non-running hours to eating and sleeping, and especially sleeping. So thank you very much. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Zoe Romano is running the equivalent of a marathon each day, and she plans to finish running the course of the Tour de France on July 20th. Some of the distinctions between Willie Mays and Mickey Mantle were obvious. The former is black, the latter was white. Willie didn't drink, and for decades, Mickey couldn't stop. But as Alan Barra points out, in Mickey and Willie, Mantle and Mays, the parallel lives of baseball's golden age, the similarities between the two transcendent ballplayers were striking. The author joins me from NPR's New York Bureau. Alan Barra, welcome back to Only a Game.
Nice to be here.
Let's start with what Mickey Mantle and Willie Mays shared. They both began their careers in center field for teams in the New York spotlight. They were both destined to make the Hall of Fame. And in their earliest days in the majors, both of them had serious doubts about whether they belonged there. How did each handle the doubt?
First of all, I've got to say something. A trivia expert's going to get you. When Mickey came to New York, they made him play right field, because Joe DiMaggio was in center field.
Ah, yes. Very briefly, they overlapped. Right.
Right. Mickey, the next year, took over in center. Oh, both had tremendous doubts. Mickey probably worse. His father just drove and drove him to be a ball player. It was the only way out that he could see of being a miner, you know, working in the mines, which was brutal, awful work. Willie, I think, had fewer doubts, probably. Didn't doubt his own ability. Willie's father was a steel worker in Birmingham, or right outside of Birmingham. The only doubt that Willie, I think, really had was whether or not the major leagues were going to integrate. One thing they both had in common, I think they were the last products of something that vanished about 1950, what I would call industrial league baseball. That's where companies would provide uniforms, bats, equipment, all kinds of stuff for their workers to play baseball. I doubt whether Mickey Mantle and Willie Mays would have become major league players had their fathers not been industrial league ball players.
Willie Mays played in the Negro Leagues during the late 40s, and he had at least seen some cities before he reached New York. That gave him an advantage over Mantle, right?
Mantle was a hick, and there's a nicer way of saying it. And it's true, Willie had traveled in the Negro Leagues. He'd been to New York. He'd seen many of the big cities. It's also true that he only saw basically one side of the big cities, but that's a lot more than Mickey Mantle saw. When Willie came to the big leagues, the Giants had people to help him out. They hired people to help him, teach him how to dress, teach him how to tip in restaurants. Mickey, he didn't have anyone looking out for him, and he signed over his endorsement rights to a shyster. I mean, none of that was necessary. The Yankees should have had somebody there to help him, and they didn't.
In the 1951 World Series, after the Yankees with a very young Mickey Mantle had beaten the Giants with a very young Willie Mays, Mantle went back home to Commerce, Oklahoma, for what you call in the book the last hours of pure relaxation that he would know for the rest of his life. That's a very dramatic statement. What did you mean?
He was certainly a hometown hero, and he was certainly known, but he wasn't yet a national celebrity. And you could hang out in the pool hall, you know, buy drinks for people. He was still one of the group. It wasn't as if everybody was hitting him up for favors or money, which was much the case later on. After that, the pressure became enormous. The pain from injuries, the mental anguish of his father's death, and something that plagued him for the rest of the decade. Mickey was counted 4F by the draft board just about the time the Korean War was getting underway. So not only does he have to feel the pain every day of these injuries, he's got to undergo this merciless booing as if it was Mickey's fault, as if it was his call, which, of course, it wasn't. Now, Willie gets to go into the Army and does nothing but play baseball the entire time he's there.
Willie Mays didn't have many opportunities to play in the World Series, and when he was on the big stage, he was not especially successful. Mantle, on the other hand, was brilliant in the World Series, but he was never particularly impressive in All-Star games, where Mays was completely magnificent. It's kind of a strange symmetry, isn't it?
It is, but let's remember that the World Series games count, and the All-Star games really don't. Willie, I think, in the World Series he played in twice against Mickey, did nothing significant except make that incredible catch in the 1954 World Series. Willie did have one other significant moment in the World Series. He changed baseball history. In 1951, in the second game of the series of their rookie seasons, Willie hits a fairly deep fly ball. Mickey Mantle is going after because he was instructed to take anything he could to take the strain off Joe DiMaggio. Mickey steps on a drain pipe, a cover that was left off, and wrenches his knee terribly, and he was never the same. I believe that play kept Mickey Mantle from being the greatest player in baseball history.
You know, I'm a little uncomfortable with the drift of this conversation, Alan, because I grew up in New Jersey, a Giants fan in the 50s, New York and then San Francisco Giants, and so I know Willie Mays was the greatest player ever, but I guess
well,
for...
Well, I did, too.
I grew up
in a Willie Mays household. I loved both of them.
So you're not making the case that Mantle was better as we speak because it feels as if we're drifting that way.
It depends on your definition of better. Over a length of time, over a career. If that's your criteria, then Willie Mays was the best. He was better longer But if you want to talk about peak seasons, like three or four peak seasons, I don't think there's any question looking back on it now that Mickey was 1956, 1957, and probably 61 and maybe 62. Not merely better than Willie, but better than anybody up to that time.
It's evident throughout Mickey and Willie that you hold both players in high esteem, and certainly did while you were growing up. How do you feel about the two men now?
There was a week in 1969 when I was a gopher at the Birmingham News, and I found out that Mickey had been in town and had gone on a drinking tear, with one of my idols, Paul Bear Bryant, the Alabama football coach. Willie, that same week, I heard at his fried chicken and hamburger place in Birmingham, he got into a verbal battle with an editor at one of the black newspapers in town about his lack of involvement with the civil rights movement. And I mean total lack of involvement. You reach a point in your life where you measure yourself against the person that you thought you wanted to be when you were younger. And then maybe have to cut your idols some slack, because it's really tough to carry the burden of someone's dreams. You have to understand that they're simply not going to be able to live up to your ideal. I came to terms with it. I think overall, I look back on it, I look at the pressure, what was expected of Mickey Mantle and Willie Mays, and I'd have to say they did okay.
Alan Vera is the author of Mickey and Willie, Mantle and Mays, The Parallel Lives of Baseball's Golden Age. The book is published by Crown, and the author joined me from NPR's New York Bureau. Alan, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Bill, it's been a pleasure.
Baseball fans in the 50s and 60s debated Mickey and Willie, but there have been a lot of great center fielders. What about Ken Griffey Jr., Mike Trout, and the third guy in that old song, Duke Snyder? Tell us about your favorite center fielder of all time at facebook.com/onlyagameradio.
I love Mickey.
Mickey who?
Mickey you.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals serving global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. And Eton, offering the American Red Cross radio line, a portable solar-powered radio with cell phone charger and flashlight for emergencies or travel. Now at Best Buy. This is NPR.
If jog you must, then jog you will, no matter what I say. But should you meet a kangaroo while you are on your way, beware of that marsupial. He may look soft and furry, but one may do to you what one did to Shane Rattenbury, that politician in Australia who got clawed and whacked while jogging past a grazing kangaroo, which then attacked. The moral of this tale is clear. Don't jog out there alone. Or if you must, then find yourself a kangaroo-free zone. For joggers free the kangaroos of all their inhibitions, and kangaroos, like lots of folks, aren't fond of politicians. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, extreme adventures in kayaking in the path of one of the sport's pioneers. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
The defending champion LA Kings are perfect at home, at least in the playoffs. If only they could play all their remaining games at home, they'd be assured of keeping the cup, right?
But then the National Hockey League would be sued by the teams they're playing. Yeah, they are very good in their own rink, as they said, and they're once again peaking in the playoffs, as they did last year.
The Blue Jackets, on the other hand, didn't even make the postseason, so clearly ticket sales must be in the toilet in Columbus.
No, for some reason, they've gone up. They had a 13% improvement in renewals and sold almost 1,000 new ticket plans.
In the NBA Conference Finals, the Indiana Pacers blew a chance to stun the Miami Heat with a Game 1 overtime victory, but no one seemed to think that it was a good idea to defend against the best player in the world with 2.1 seconds left in the game. Were you among those wondering why nobody stepped in front of LeBron James on the inbound?
There's a remarkable photo of all five Indiana Pacers, who did not include center Roy Hibbert, by the way, for reasons that surpass this understanding. Of LeBron James just shooting a layup while all five Pacers stood there and apparently applauded.
Yeah.
On Tuesday, the Cleveland Cavaliers won the opportunity to select first in the NBA draft. Second time in 3 years they've had that opportunity. Shouldn't they be getting better by now?
Well, I would think so. I mean, they really did do it well once, and then LeBron James went to Miami.
Apparently, although Chicago is in the process of closing 54 schools and 6 mental health centers, the city still has $100 million for a new building in which DePaul will play basketball games. You want to help me with the math here?
This one is baffling to me. I mean, I know it's supposed to be the centerpiece of some sort of phony baloney development, which will, you know, provide a lot of minimum wage jobs. But $100 million of taxpayers' money for a mediocre basketball team is quite astonishing.
Mike Rice, late the men's basketball coach at Rutgers, is receiving counseling for anger management at John Lucas's Wellness and Aftercare program in Houston. While Rice is in treatment, he's also coaching for Lucas's pre-NBA draft camp. I don't pretend to know all that much about this sort of thing, but therapy as coaching?
Well, I mean, you go back to your normal life, I guess, and, you know, if you're going to see if you can manage your anger, which was demonstrated while you were coaching basketball, it's probably easier to do if you coach basketball.
All right, okay, I'll go along with that. The New Orleans Saints will pay Sean Payton $8 million this season. That makes him the highest-paid coach in U.S. sports. And I guess the Saints must be figuring Payton is tanned, rested, and ready after serving his suspension in connection with a bounty scandal that helped derail the team last year.
Well, actually, it's funny because Payton signed an extension in September 2011, only that extension got voided because of the suspension. The voided contract gave him a chance to renegotiate. Now he's making more money.
Making more money. Brian Urlacher of the Chicago Bears announced his retirement this week. Would it be an exaggeration to say that he had become the face of the franchise?
Oh, yeah. But the Bears have had iconic faces down through the years, all the way from when George Halas began the team, all the way through Mike Ditka, now Brian Urlacher. He spent his entire career with the Bears. He will be the face of the Bears going forward.
Angel slugger Mike Trout hit for the cycle on Tuesday, Charlie, thus becoming the first major leaguer to do so in 2013. And it's a good thing, too, because otherwise the Angels might have been in trouble, huh?
Well, I mean, I think it's probably easier to hit for the cycle when everybody seems to be hitting everything. The Angels beat the Mariners 12-0. Even Albert Pujols got an RBI. But this is still quite a feat because he's the youngest player in the history of the American League to do it.
One of the first things that you learn when you play a team sport is not to embarrass your teammates by blaming them for team losses. And I guess maybe Nationals closer Rafael Soriano was absent from class on the day that was the lesson, because this week he told reporters outfielder Bryce Harper had been out of position when Soriano gave up a triple.
First of all, you don't do that to your teammates. Second of all, you don't do that to your face of the franchise, which Bryce Harper is. Alfonso Soriano probably shouldn't have given up a hard hit line drive, I think would be my rejoinder.
I think so, too. I think maybe he thought he would get away with it because he gave his answer in Spanish. Maybe he figured nobody would ever understand. Golfer Sergio Garcia is in the spotlight this week. First, he said that he'd like to invite Tiger Woods to dinner and serve fried chicken. Then he apologized profusely. And then the head of the European Tour tried to come to his rescue. How'd that go over?
Well, that didn't go very well because George O'Grady, the chief of the European Tour, said, quote, most of Sergio's friends are colored athletes in the United States.
Oh, very good.
So things get worse and worse.
On Tuesday, the USGA announced that in short order, a rule will go into effect banning the so-called belly putter, and some of the golfers using the belly putter have since sought the advice of an attorney, one Harry Mannion, right here in Boston.
That's
Do they
right.
have a case?
I haven't the faintest idea. I mean, I would assume that golf is entitled to make its own rules. It's been making its own rules for 700 years. I don't know that they have a third leg to stand on here.
That was very good.
Thank
the belly
you.
Putter,
yeah.
Yes.
It's
funny because it's
it's true.
Okay, starting in 2015, Major League Soccer will have a second team in New York. And since the majority owner will be Sheikh Mansour bin Zayed bin Sultan Al Nahyan of Abu Dhabi, meeting payroll should not be an issue. The minority partner in this endeavor will be the New York Yankees. So does this immediately become the best team in Major League Soccer?
I haven't the faintest idea. It'll certainly be the most well-appointed. I mean, the other partner, of course, is Manchester City, which is owned by Sultan, et
yes,
cetera, et
exactly.
cetera.
Have the Yankees ever been a minority partner in anything?
Well, I don't think they're going to. The thing I think the Sultan doesn't understand is they will not behave like a minority partner, whether they're a minority partner or not.
And finally, Charlie. Chuck Norris
has urged
the Jacksonville Jaguars to employ itinerant quarterback Tim Tebow this week. He referenced Martin Luther King in the process, asking the owner of the Jaguars to, quote, take a position that is neither safe nor politic nor popular because conscience tells him that it is right. So good reasoning.
Here's a tip for Chuck Norris. Martin Luther King was really good at being a civil rights leader. Tim Tebow is really bad at being a quarterback.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at Grantland, among other places. Charlie, thanks very much.
Thanks, Bill.
They call me Walker, Texas Ranger, because my roundhouse kicks are super sweet.
Chris Sale, the 24-year-old pitcher for the Chicago White Sox, has yet to win a World Series game, but according to teammate Adam Dunn, Sale is already a champion. As Dunn puts it, he eats more than anybody on earth. That's half of what led Brian Costa of the Wall Street Journal to write about Chris Sale this week. Brian, what else about this young pitcher has been fascinating people?
Well, just his body type is so rare in baseball. He's 6'6" and only 180 pounds, so he's just looks remarkably thin on the mound, which, you know, would lead a lot of people to assume that, you know, maybe he doesn't eat that much, but he's actually a monstrous eater, and yet he doesn't put on any weight, so I think a lot of people would be kind of jealous of that.
Well, let's be a little more specific about what Chris Sale eats. He lists In-N-Out Burger, McDonald's, and Taco Bell among his favorite restaurants, and he says he chows down on pizza, cheeseburgers, and baby back ribs. This is not exactly the recommended diet of champions, is it?
No, no, it's not. I don't think a basketball player would have that diet, for example, but, you know, it's one of those things where if you keep your physique and you're performing, no one's going to care much how many chicken fingers you eat in the afternoon.
Chris Sale has said flexibility rather than muscles account for his success as a pitcher. He almost didn't have to say that when you look at him. But he told you, I can do things with my arms that make guys throw up sometimes. He wasn't referring to opposing hitters, was he?
No. He did not give me a demonstration, thankfully, of the kind of things that would make people throw up. But, you know, you can kind of use your imaginations as to what sort of body contortions he's able to do. I wrote the story. He was only the fifth player in Major League history to be 6'6" or taller and also 180 pounds or less. So, you know, it's not often you see someone quite that skinny.
Did any of Sale's teammates tell you that they hate him because he can eat all day and not gain weight?
I think he pitches too well for them to hate him, but a few of them kind of spoke wistfully about their younger days and kind of missing, you know, what it's like to be 24 and when they could do that a little more easily. I don't think any of them did it quite as easily as he does or ate quite as much as he does. You know, he looks at it as this sort of foreign concept of you know, eating fruits and, you know, cutting down on the chili cheese dogs. It's, you know, I don't think he's looking forward to his older years if that's what it's going to be like.
Did Chris Sale have any problem with you writing about him as a metabolic freak rather than as a successful major league pitcher?
You know, I haven't heard from Chris himself since the story ran. You know, I heard from someone with the White Sox that they liked the story and felt like it captured him well. But I would not think he'd have a problem with it. I think one of the really nice things about Chris Sale is, you know, not only is he very good, he's a smart, articulate guy, but, you know, he's also able to laugh at himself. He can take it, and I think he does as good a job as of anybody as laughing about it and you know, being okay with it.
Brian Costa is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal, and his story about Chris Sale ran in Monday's edition. You can find a link to that story at onlyagame.org. Brian, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill.
For the past few weeks, kayakers from around the country have come to the upper Midwest to paddle the dozens of rivers and streams that plummet over waterfalls on their way to Lake Superior. It's world-class whitewater kayaking, at least while the snow is in full melt, in a place flooded with the exploits of a kayaking legend. Dan Crocker reports.
Along the north shore of Lake Superior in far northeast Minnesota, streams like the Lester River in Duluth are roaring, full of chocolate-brown, frothy, churning spring runoff. It's that time of year when hikers are warned to stay away from the creeks, and when kayakers like Chris Bear grab their paddles.
It's phenomenal. It really is great paddling for about a month a year.
Bear is about as close as you can get to a professional kayaker. He's a raft guide for about half the year in Colorado and West Virginia, but spends the other 6 months kayaking around the globe. And he says the whitewater here, at least for a few weeks, is as good as it gets.
When it's all melting, it comes down fast, and that 1,000 feet of gradient from the ambient landmass down into Lake Superior works in our favor, and we get some really cool rapids for a month here.
Bear calls them rapids, but to most people, this is a waterfall, a 20-foot, nearly 90-degree class 5 plunge into a deep rocky gorge. Bear shoots the fall smoothly, but gets stuck in a powerful hydraulic at the bottom, where the water recirculates like a giant washing machine, momentarily trapping his boat. He has to swim to shore. But determined, he drags his boat up for a second run. This time, he angles his kayak perfectly and slides just past the whirlpool.
Yeah, it just takes a little practice. Woo!
All the way up Minnesota's North Shore and in northern Wisconsin and Michigan, a select group of expert kayakers braves rivers with names like the Cascade and Devil's Track. The streams are only a few miles long. Some are really just creeks, but they're steep. They come tumbling down hundreds of feet from the ridges that rise up from Lake Superior and feature razor-sharp rocks, three-story vertical drops, and frigid water.
I think you have to be of a different character to run the rivers on the North Shore. I'll put it as diplomatically as I can, maybe a little bit crazy as well.
That's John Kiffmeyer, who's paddled the upper Midwest for nearly two decades and now works for a kayak company called Liquid Logic in Asheville, North Carolina.
I remember one video where somebody had flipped coming down one of the slides and it had cut the top of his eye so that his eyelid wasn't connected anymore. I mean, it's not without danger. I myself have broken both my ankles going over a waterfall.
But Kiffmeyer says the paddlers who tackle these rivers are comfortable in water that, to the untrained eye, looks, well, kind of nuts.
There's things that you're doing with your paddle, with your body, with your boat angle, with your core, and you can't see all of that happening, but there's a lot of premeditated action that's going in. That's happening because of instinct. That's happening because you've spent so much time on the water. You know what to do.
Kiffmeyer and a host of other paddlers were introduced to these creeks by a kayaking legend named Jim Rada. He was an astronomy professor at the University of Wisconsin and the first person to run several local rivers. Kiffmeyer says Rada's guidebook, Northwoods Whitewater, was like kayaking gospel.
His book was it. I mean, if you wanted to go kayaking, you would do everything to try and find one. And originally, that was very difficult. I've got what's called the Kinko's edition.
Which means Rada photocopied the pages and gave them to Kiffmeyer for $20. He says Rada insisted on meeting people first.
Because he felt very personally responsible. He had written these descriptions of the rivers. He guided you to them. And so there was a sense of personal responsibility that he had that he wanted you to be safe.
Paul Everson, who was a longtime paddling companion of Rada's, says he bought the first copy.
Which was very odd to be vetted by this long-haired, hippie-looking guy. He sort of looked like the friendly Norwegian troll. He sort of had long, kind of dreadlocky hair and a big, long, unkempt beard and had little eyes that twinkled like an elf.
But Everson, now a scientist at a biotech company in St. Paul, says Rada was also straight-laced. He never touched soda, let alone alcohol. But 10 years ago this month, on a trip down the Presque Isle River in Michigan's Upper Peninsula, Rada flipped over at the bottom of a waterfall.
And he was upside down. He came floating out of the hole upside down, and then he was unresponsive. He couldn't roll up. The boat wiggled a little, and that's all that happened.
His kayak floated downstream over a Class 5 waterfall. They didn't find his body until the next day. A few days later, they learned he had died from a heart attack, which Everson says was a feeling of relief.
The whole way you think about it changed. He had a heart attack, and he had a heart attack doing something that he loved, what he loved the most, probably on one of his favorite rivers.
Everson says it would have been different if Rada had died as the result of a whitewater accident.
Fingers start pointing, oh, see, you know, got the old guy doing the river he shouldn't be doing, and, you know, you guys are not as good as you think you are.
Rada's book was finally published in 2006, and this past weekend, Everson and Kiffmeyer and more than a dozen other paddlers raced down the Presque Isle River in his honor, dropping some of his ashes in the water so he could float down the raging river alongside them one more time. For Only a Game, I'm Dan Crocker in Duluth, Minnesota.
To view Dan Crocker's kayaking photos, please visit our website, onlyagame.org.
'Cause when you are a-wondering how to make me be your girl, just take me in the broad daylight to where the mighty rapids swirl. I wanna go kayaking, wanna make you my kayak king. I can hardly wait for our first date when we go kayaking.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Alex Smith at KCUR in Kansas City. Our intern is Jasper Wilson, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. Our final word comes from Sam Presti, the general manager of the Oklahoma City Thunder.
Any thoughts and prayers for this city and the people that have been affected would mean a tremendous amount, and I know I can speak for the community of Oklahoma City and the state of Oklahoma when I say that.
Consider the word passed on. May it fall on receptive ears. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you next week.
We go kayaking. And let's not forget the Amazon scene in which I play the African queen and I kayak before two.
Support comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org. The SCAN Foundation, committed to aging with dignity and independence at thescanfoundation.org. And the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to a vigorous presence for poetry in American culture. Poetryfoundation.org. This is NPR.